It's the takeaway for July 9th. You've got your mind on your money and your money on your health care.
Insurance was fighting with my doctor when I needed surgery.
Our son gets a monthly allergy shot for $3,000 per injection. Our new insurance company covers only $800 monthly.
I have to discuss money with every provider I see.
The conversation on healthcare often focuses on the uninsured, why having health insurance isn't a cure-all to health costs. And Facebook is trying to get into the cryptocurrency game, and that has government regulators worried.
Think of a currency like this trying to eventually replace how we use currency in the real world. And that, I think, just makes folks nervous automatically.
Let's get to it. When we talk about healthcare in this country, we often talk about the uninsured. But for those Americans lucky enough to actually be covered, having insurance still doesn't mean having affordable or straightforward access to care. Millions of insured Americans face an expensive and confusing maze of paperwork, phone calls, billing battles, and dead ends as they try to secure care for themselves and their families. It's happened to me, and it's also happened to many of you.
After paying your copay, often your doctor will ask you to take a test or have a procedure done. You assume, because your doctor asked you, it's part of what needs to be covered in your visit. It's not. You'll never find out what it's going to cost you till you get the bill.
Well, it has been a challenge the last couple of years. Just finding a doctor in my network that takes new patients has been somewhat difficult. And for my last physical, the doctor said she could not even tell me what would or would not be covered by my insurance. I told her I only wanted work done that was covered under preventive care. I ended up getting a bill for $349. I had to fight for 6 months to get that bill reduced.
I found that even with health insurance, it can be a nightmare to secure care. I've had providers drop my insurance, sometimes abruptly, once on my way to an appointment, and I've had my insurance drop my providers. Even getting referrals to specialists is a bureaucratic and logistical nightmare.
Thanks for sharing your stories with us, and you can keep them coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation polling, more than one-third of insured adults say it's difficult for them to afford to pay their insurance deductible. And half of U.S. adults say they or a family member have delayed or skipped care in the last year because of cost. Insurance in America has only gotten more complicated and expensive over time. And it's also gotten more political. Today, the Affordable Care Act is facing its latest threat in a New Orleans court. An appeals court panel of judges will hear arguments in a case led by Texas and other GOP states with the backing of the Department of Justice, all of whom are trying to see the ACA declared unconstitutional. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And we have two people here to help us explain why insurance is so complicated and what some solutions might be. Elizabeth Rosenthal is editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and a non-practicing physician. She's also the author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. And J.B. Silvers is a professor of healthcare finance at Case Western Reserve University. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Tanzina.
Good to be here.
JB, let's start with you. We know the range of costs for healthcare vary widely, but what do Americans tend to pay for health insurance on average, and are there regional differences?
Well, they're all over the place. The total cost per capita for healthcare is over $10,000. The average insurer and the average insurance person pays, non-elderly family pays about $8,000. A big chunk of that is in tax payments, but directly, they pay about $2,200 out of pocket. But the variation is wild, from very high cost states like New Jersey to very much lower cost states like Montana. They're all over the place.
Elizabeth, one of the reasons we wanted to do this segment is because not only me, but so many of our listeners have said that they have insurance and healthcare is still unaffordable. I want to play you a call from Amanda. Take a listen.
I'm a North Carolina teacher who lives in Lenore. Affording care has been a constant struggle for me, especially the past 3 years. Unexpected surgeries and a clotting disorder have required many doctor's visits, and money has always been a deciding factor in my decisions. I have to discuss money with every provider I see.
Elizabeth, how common is that experience?
Oh, it's extremely common. And it's really tragic that that becomes the deciding factor in care. A lot of your listeners talked about the nightmare of trying to access health care and afford it. And I think that's where we are today.
You know, I think, Elizabeth, about, you know, many, many years ago when it was really just a copay. And I say just a copay because it felt like that was the only thing if you were in network that you were paying for. Now, I think we're getting bills, we're paying coinsurance. Why does it feel like we're paying more for this?
Well, I think more and more costs are being passed off to the patients because often, you know, your company has maxed out what it feels it can pay if you're lucky enough to have insurance. The insurer doesn't want to take any less. They say, we need this money. And so the kind of mutual agreement is, well, we'll increase deductibles, we'll increase premiums, the employee contribution, we'll have co-pays in-network, out-network, co-insurance in-network and out-work, network, out-of-network. So it's become increasingly common. And what's happened, I think, is that now, you know, yes, we have a problem with the uninsured, but we have a huge segment of the population that's what some people call functionally uninsured. They may have a high deductible plan where they pay, you know, $2,000 a month for insurance for a family of four, and then they have a $4,000 deductible, and they only have $1,000 in savings. So, you know, they can't pay for the care that they need.
You know, JB, we hear a lot about protections for pre-existing conditions, and you've written a lot about how that's just one small piece of the puzzle when it comes to access to good insurance. What do you mean by that?
Well, part of the trouble is that insurance companies are trying to, they're the middlemen. We blame them because nobody loves their insurance company, but it's really the underlying healthcare costs that are going up so fast that have caused troubles. And so in order to stay competitive, the insurance companies tried to do everything they could to hold down costs, including, as Elizabeth mentioned, passing on a larger and larger share of that total cost to the employee. That's the way they keep it down. Before the Affordable Care Act, they also tried to get rid of pre-existing conditions because you know you're going to pay for those people. And that's not insurance. That's just financing them. You also then put up a lot of barriers in. Even under the Affordable Care Act, probably one out of five claims are denied. You have to go fight with the insurance company. No one likes to do that. But the underlying culprit is the healthcare cost.
Hmm. Elizabeth, a lot of Americans, as we mentioned, get insurance through their employer, but a lot of that is shifting to the employee. How are employers managing the cost of care?
Yeah, you know, I said in my book, they've kind of been asleep at the wheel for many years. They've just kind of watched these costs go up and, you know, they hire consultants who try and get them better plans. But ultimately, they can't afford these rising costs either. And it's eating into their ability to give their employees raises, to be profitable. It's crazy difficult to start a company if you want to cover your health care costs. So what their solution has been to pass more and more over to patients. And in an era of high deductible plans and rising costs, that puts patients in a totally impossible position. And what you're hearing, I think, from both of us is patients are just stuck and they don't know who to blame. They don't know who to be angry at. And it's kind of everyone. It's the system that has allowed these costs to get out of control without any good way to address them.
You know, one thing that often comes up when we're talking about insurance is mental health specifically. There have been a lot of reports recently on ghost networks or for psychiatric and psychological services where people will look for an in-network provider and half of those folks don't even work with that provider anymore. And whether or not they can find in-network providers who even take insurance. I want to play a call from Mary. Take a listen.
The only difficulties that we've experienced is finding mental health professionals who accept any insurance. This has proven to be very difficult, and thus we have paid out of pocket at tremendous expense to us as a family.
Elizabeth, given the concerns of this country and its mental health state right now, how severe is this problem?
Well, this is a huge problem, especially since the Affordable Care Act, one of its kind of core tenets was parity for mental health care, right, which there isn't today. As the caller said, you know, it's very hard to find in-network mental health providers, particularly if you have a kind of mental health needs that needs medication, so you need a psychiatrist. But the caller goes, and your previous caller goes to another question, which we should ask our insurance commissioners and state's attorneys general to to help us with. You know, you go to a directory and they have all these names, but they're not people who are actually in your network that day, or as a former caller said, they're in network but not taking new patients. I mean, what on earth does that mean if I'm a consumer? I think we need to demand that those directories be accurate up to the day, and that they really have providers who are in network who can help us. It's, you know, what does it mean to say in network but not taking new patients? That's not helpful to me.
Yeah, JB, we mentioned at the top that there's a political element that's happening today. The Affordable Care Act is facing a major challenge in court today in New Orleans. What is the future? I mean, how do you see this challenge right now? What could this mean in terms of the future of the ACA?
Well, I wish I knew. If it turns out negative, the challenge is to wipe out all of the Affordable Care Act, not just part of it. And if that happened, it would be a huge blow to the American healthcare system, because as bad as things are right now, they were much worse before, particularly beyond the Obamacare exchanges. That's the one that gets all the attention. But the expansion of the Medicaid program, getting rid of pre-existing conditions, the subsidies that people get, but particularly things that have to do with the delivery of healthcare. We've got some more rules out there. And in the insurance business, what we're talking about today, they basically said insurers have to take risks and pay claims. That's just what you thought they were doing already, but they weren't doing a very good job of that. That would all go away. We'd be back to square zero. This is a very serious challenge.
Elizabeth, we talked a lot about the problems here, but I'd love to know, what are some things that patients and Americans can do to help themselves with this? Do we have any recourse?
Yeah, and this is part of why I've been writing about it and why I wrote the book, that I think we feel helpless in the face of this behemoth. But there are actually, for elective care, there are some simple things you can do, which I do myself, especially in an era of high deductible plans where you're paying the price. So, for example, if you go to your doctor, as one of the callers said, and he or she says, oh, you just have to have these extra blood tests, your doctor's computer is likely programmed to send those to his or her hospital, which is likely to be the most expensive place to get those blood tests in your town. I say to my doctor now, great, I'll get those, but give me a requisition. I'm going to walk down the block to Quest or LabCorp and get them done. And the price difference can literally be, for a vitamin D test, $7 versus $700 coming out of your pocket. So likewise, for x-rays, you should do that. I tell everyone when they go into a hospital and they give you those financial disclosure forms that say, I agree to pay everything that my insurer doesn't cover. I write in every time. I did it for my husband and my mother this last couple of months, so long as it's in my insurance network. Now, will that protect you legally right this second? Maybe, maybe not. But surprise bills, out-of-network bills are all in the news. Hospitals are very sensitive, and it will give you a sense, a sense of control and a leg to stand on when you're calling, fighting that good fight to not pay a surprise bill that you didn't know was coming.
Elizabeth Rosenthal is editor-in-chief of Kaiser Health News and a non-practicing physician, and also author of An American Sickness, How Healthcare Became Big Business and How You Can Take It Back. J.B. Silvers is a professor of healthcare finance at Case Western Reserve University. We appreciate you both. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
We're going to continue our look at healthcare, focusing now on the cost of drugs. Many of you have been telling us that the price of critical prescription drugs and treatment is affecting your lives.
My name is Catherine Berglund, and I'm calling from Incline Village, Nevada.
Our son gets a monthly allergy shot that retails for $3,000 per injection. Our new insurance company covers only $800 monthly. The pharmaceutical company helps families with about $12,000 in subsidies annually. Well, it's July. Do the math.
One-fourth of Americans taking prescription drugs say they have trouble affording them. That's according to a recent study by the Kaiser Family Foundation. And in some cases, the high costs have forced Americans to choose between paying for their medication or paying for their rent. Margot Sanger-Katz is a healthcare reporter for the New York Times, and she joins us now. Welcome to The Takeaway, Margot.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we just heard our caller, Catherine, say that she's struggling to pay for these allergy shots. People in the United States are saying they're feeling crunched by prescription drug prices. Why have costs been significantly increasing? Have they been increasing? And what's the state of costs today?
actually think the caller's story illustrates two things that are happening at the same time that are making this such a poignant issue for people. So one is that the price of many drugs is increasing. The drug companies tend to increase their prices every year, in some cases a couple of times a year. And of course, here in the United States, we pay the highest prices in the world for drugs to begin with. So these are expensive drugs that are getting more expensive. That's one piece of the puzzle. But the other is that increasingly people's health insurance is asking them to pay more and more of the upfront cost of their medications before the insurance kicks in. So we see more people with large deductibles or different kinds of coinsurance, and the caller had that problem as well, right? It's not just that the allergy shot cost $3,000, it's also that the insurance company would only pay a fraction of that. So as both of those things are happening, we're seeing more and more people becoming really concerned about their exposure to these high costs.
You mentioned that these are really complicated systems. I mean, I was recently on a call with the prescription company that we have, and I said to her, I said, you know, I have a master's degree, I'm a journalist, I can understand complicated things, but this particular issue feels Byzantine almost in its level of complexity. Are many Americans aware that they have options in terms of generics versus brand name drugs, or do they just sort of take whatever the doctor prescribes and then try to make it work?
So one thing that's happened over the last few decades, actually, is that many common drugs that people take for serious health problems have gone off patent and are now available as generic medications. Something like 90% of all prescriptions that are filled in the United States are for generic drugs. And that's good for drug costs because when a drug becomes a generic, it means lots of different manufacturers can make it and compete with each other. The prices tend to come down quite a lot. And in most cases, there are laws that say that unless the doctor specifically says, give this person the brand name drug, they will just automatically substitute for a generic drug at the pharmacy counter. So you don't even know it, but you're getting a generic, you're getting the benefit of those lower costs. But I think in cases where there isn't necessarily a generic for your particular medication, those are situations where it can be harder to navigate the system. You know, sometimes the insurance company is getting a good deal on one drug. They want you to take this one drug for, say, heartburn, and for that drug, there's almost no copayment. And then there's another drug that they didn't get as good a deal on, and they don't want you to take that one, and that one's got a $100 copayment. Well, your doctor, when you see that doctor for heartburn, may not know what your insurance company's deals are with these two drugs. If they write you a prescription for the more expensive drug, when you go to the pharmacist doesn't really easily have the ability to switch you to the cheaper one. You need to find out that there's one that's cheaper that's available. You need to be able to go back to your doctor, get a new prescription. So you can see why lots of people get frustrated in this system. It's hard to get to the doctor. It costs money. It takes time. And then to get a new prescription, it may not be exactly what your doctor wanted.
Let's talk a little bit about how politics is impacting this area right now. From the beginning of President Trump's 2016 campaign until very recently, he's been promising to lower drug prices. What has the Trump administration done so far to reach that goal?
So far, the Trump administration has talked a lot about this, and they have started doing some things, but most of them have not really come to fruition. So, you know, one thing they did or they tried to do was to require drug makers to tell their prices in their commercials. So if you see a commercial, you know, you're watching the Super Bowl and you see a commercial for a prescription drug, they would need to say, here's how much it costs. That actually was struck down by a court just yesterday. The court said actually they're not allowed to do that. They've done some other things that have been designed to help bring generics to market. So when a patent expires on a brand name drug, often what happens is that the drug maker tries to prevent competition from entering the market, and they use various strategies for this. So there have been some things that have happened through regulation, and then there are some things that Congress is working on that would try to speed up that transition so we can get more competition for drugs. And then there are some bigger things that are in the pipeline. I think the most interesting of these is for the category of drugs like an allergy shot that a doctor gives you in their office or that you get in a hospital. So think like chemotherapy drugs for cancer or saline when you're in the hospital, not the drugs you get at the pharmacy counter. For those kinds of drugs, the Trump administration wants to test out a completely different way for figuring out the price. What they want to do is look at what foreign governments pay for those drugs. A kind of basket of 15 or 16 foreign governments take kind of an average and pay a price based on what they're calling this international price index. So that would cause the prices for many of these drugs to be much lower. That has not been finalized yet, but it's kind of in the works. It looks like it's coming soon. I would say that's the most aggressive thing that the Trump administration has done that would really take a direct whack at the prices for these brand name drugs.
You mentioned Congress. There have been a number of congressional hearings on the high cost of prescription drugs just this last year alone. But has any actual progress been made on that front?
I do think so. I would not describe any of the bills that are moving closer to passage in Congress as being big deal, game changer kinds of bills. But these are, you know, sort of carefully constructed bills that are dealing with sort of weirdnesses and inefficiencies in the pathway between brand name drugs and generic drugs. And there are a bunch of them that are making their way through. They've been considered by committees. Some of these bills have been passed already by the House of Representatives. And it seems like there is bipartisan consensus that some of these policies ought to be made law. There seems to be some agreement between both the House and the Senate, which we don't always see. And of course, President Trump has signaled that this is a big priority for him. So it's difficult to predict. Congress, all kinds of weird things could happen. But it certainly looks as though we're going to see some bills that address drug pricing finding their way into law by the end of this year. These are small changes. They are going to improve some efficiencies and maybe lower the prices of some drugs, but they're not going to kind of take a whack across the board at what we're paying for medications.
Margot Sanger-Katz is a healthcare reporter for The New York Times. Thank you, Margot.
Thank you.
Last month, Facebook announced its latest plans to create a cryptocurrency called Libra and a digital wallet known as Calibra. This would have been the biggest attempt by a company to get involved in cryptocurrency, an often unstable and risky form of currency. But now the House Oversight Committee is asking the social media giant to stop all activities related to the digital products until they can assess their risks and opportunities for regulation. Mike Isaac is a tech reporter for The New York Times, and he's been covering Facebook's foray into finance. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start with a big picture question here. I mean, we've heard about Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, and it kind of feels like I don't own any of those. I'm not interested in any of those. Who is buying cryptocurrencies? Who is it? Who's the target market for this?
No, that's a great point. I think the big reason that Facebook kind of wants to get into this is to date, it's been really hard to buy basically any sort of cryptocurrency. You sort of have to download a program, you have to find some sort of funky exchange online, and it's unclear whether your money's going to get hacked or your account's going to get broken into. It's very complicated right now, and I think it's mostly been relegated to like sort of really hardcore enthusiasts or even niche finance or banking fetishists even. And so Facebook's whole point is, look, we want to make this type of financial exchange mainstream, and to do that, they want to sort of bake that into two of their biggest products, which are Facebook Messenger and WhatsApp. And they've built this subsidiary, as you said, called Calibra to do that, and making their dollars or yen or whatever it is electronic much faster and they claim much safer and easier to store.
Now, what would I have been able to do with this currency on WhatsApp or Facebook? Does it mean I can buy anything I want?
The big sort of caveat is it's all very theoretical right now. They haven't actually gotten it running. It's supposed to go in 2020. But in theory, you know, you could go through Calibra, which is Facebook's version of like a bank / digital wallet, and exchange your dollars for Libra, which is the currency. And then right now, it's mostly about financial transfers. So think about, you know, your relatives or cousins or whoever you have living in many different parts of the world. Money transfers is a huge activity for folks, especially coming from U.S. to other countries. And right now, you know, it can take a lot of really sort of low-tech real world planning to do it. You might have to go to Western Union. You might have to stand in line at a banking office to get there. And so Facebook says, why don't we just sort of have you exchange your dollars to Libra send that Libra via WhatsApp to someone else as if it were like a Venmo transfer, and then have them either hold it in their wallet or cash out. And the theory is you could introduce people who don't even have bank accounts in other parts of the developing world into a digital sort of bank account for the first time ever.
So a couple things. I mean, would Facebook make any money off of these transfers at all?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. They like to bring their new innovations in a sort of altruistic way, saying, hey, we're trying to bring banking to the unbanked and blah, blah, blah. And like part of that is true. But, you know, Facebook will never act in a way that isn't in their own self-interest. So they did admit that eventually, if this takes off, they might build things like financial services around it. So imagine Calibra being a type of banking system that could offer you loans or different types of financing one day, if enough people use Libra and decide to like actually hold their money in this. So very early days, but they could possibly, maybe they charge interest on loans over time. Maybe Facebook eventually becomes your bank. That's their sort of grand scheme going on in the background.
Now, the House Oversight Committee is concerned about Libra. What exactly worries them?
I mean, I think the big sort of takeaway here, as it were, is just to think about this is aimed squarely at overturning the entire financial system, not only in the U.S., but really globally, right? There, you can note that in the founding partners of this whole thing, there are no banks actually involved. It's mostly just sort of other companies and credit card processors and a few different tech companies even that are kind of dabbling in what cryptocurrency might do. But, you know, think of a currency like this trying to eventually replace how we use currency in the real world. And that, I think, just makes folks nervous automatically. And obviously, it makes banks sort of like bristle a little bit. Not to mention the fact that Facebook has, you know, multiple probes and FTC investigations going on right now. So add another big initiative to that, and Congress is going to want them to at least slow down the brakes a little bit.
Well, also Facebook, I mean, you mentioned the multiple investigations into Facebook, but they also have not had a good track record when it comes to privacy. And, you know, adding to that, your financial transactions might even be more concerning, no?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, their sort of caveat here is, look, we created Calibra, which is a subsidiary. We're not going to share your financial transaction info with our ad targeting systems. They're totally separate. But like, you know, imagine literally anyone believing Facebook's words at face value.
I was going to say, we've heard that before, Mike.
That's right. And they like to sort of ask forgiveness, not permission, a lot of the time. So, you know, it's going to be really hard to just sort of say, okay, you know, we believe you, go ahead and use our financial data. So I don't know. It's an uphill battle for them.
They have also gotten some pretty big backers initially. We understand that MasterCard and PayPal and Uber are all looking forward to this. What does that tell us about the market? I mean, is that going to be enough to sort of get past the House Oversight Committee's concerns and just bring this thing to market?
Yeah, I think right now it's one of those things where, you know, we've talked to a few of the different companies involved. Right now they have 20-ish partners. They're seeking to get over 100 by next year. And a lot of companies like to have a hand in this, or at least say, hey, look, we're participating. If it takes off, great. If not, no skin off our backs. But I think everyone's sort of cautiously participating right now. And if it fails, then it's on Facebook. But if it succeeds, then these other companies can at least say they've been a part of it. So my guess is Facebook goes to Congress. The CEO, David Marcus of Calibra, he'll testify. And we'll see if they buy Facebook's line of thinking.
We shall see. Mike Isaac is a tech reporter for The New York Times. Mike, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.